Hello and welcome to The Liberal Arts,
a podcast about post-grad life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody, please pay us. On this, our inaugural episode, we have come to you despite distance, despite plague, despite technical difficulties, despite turning it off and on again. So we thought we would introduce ourselves before we get started. My name is Hannah Wright. I am currently a graduate student in analytical chemistry, which is pretty much the least interesting chemistry to describe because it basically comes down to quality control, which is what I do. I've tried to quality control exposure to pollutants, air pollutants mostly, is what I'm working on right now, which sounds pretty dull, but it's not. I actually really like it. The problem is that I also like everything else. So, to allay confusion, since there are two Hannahs, you can call me Science.
My name is Hannah Nestor. I am currently working as a teacher's assistant in special education and dreaming of the day I get to go back to school and start grad school. I studied history, and that's what I really love and want to do with my life eventually. But right now I'm working and assigning myself research projects to keep from missing history too badly. In lieu of people assigning them to me, I assign them to myself. I probably need to get a life, but I'm having way too much fun. So, again, because there are two Hannahs, I will also be going by a nickname, and I will be known as Cleo, who was the Greek muse of history. So, that's me. I am a muse.
Much less on the nose than Science.
Oh, only a little, to be honest.
So yeah, I'm the brain that launched 1,000 research papers. No.
I love that. I love that so much.
Wow. My name is Rissa Willis, and I have a really terrible cold right now. So I promise this is not what my voice sounds like normally. I'm a graduate student working on my BPhil in philosophy at Oxford University. Philosophy is what I did my undergraduate degree in, and I'm trying to convince myself that I still like it. But to be honest, I lost interest about week two, and I have since then been trying to assign myself research topics that I actually like for other reasons. Because of that, my studies have led me into aesthetics, which is the philosophy of art, and I am just now starting my master's dissertation on philosophical questions involved with video games. So yeah, that's what I'm currently working on. But my big pet project right now is I'm trying out being a DM at Dungeons & Dragons for the first time. So that's where all the fun stuff happens.
She's real good at it.
Oh, thanks. We've had exactly one session. Because my name is not Hannah, I'll be going as Rissa, because that's my name.
So today we are going to talk about the Wonder Woman of the Ancient World's Justice League, and the real reason why we all need a dog. But first, Rissa, do you have a fun fact for us?
I do. My fun fact is I'm sick, but I do have a funner fact than that.
That's not really
the fact that I'm sick.
We don't take pleasure in this fact.
Did you know?
We do not.
Okay, fake fact first. Fake fact. Did you know that Vicks Vapor Rub is a miracle? Oh my god. Right now, and oh my god, I love this stuff so much. Vicks Vapor Rub is amazing. It reminds me of my childhood, and it just makes my life better.
I agree with you. As a scientist, I can confirm it is magical.
It is magic.
How does it remind you of your childhood?
Because when I was a kid and I got sick, I remember my dad would always go get this Vicks Vapor Rub right before I went to bed. I kind of put some right under my nose. And somehow this smell just kind of reminds me of my dad when I was a kid. My dad's still alive, by the way. This is not some sob story.
every time I just open to be a clear.
My dad just kind of hands it to me and like says, "Go use this." But he used to like put it on me because I was a child. Anyway, it makes me very nostalgic, but it also just makes me feel significantly better.
Yeah, I agree. My mom used to, like, slather it all over my, like, collarbone.
Yes, that too. So I fell into a little bit of a Wikipedia well. Did you know that the man who created Vicks VapoRub has a ship named after him? Well, it's a like a retired ship now, but in the U.S. military.
Really?
Not for his invention of this amazing chemical rub, but in fact because he was a lifelong supporter of African-American rights in the U.S.,
Really?
No way!
And so, yeah, in 1944, a ship was launched called the SS Lunsford Richardson. That's his name. His name is not Vicks. Vicks was actually his brother-in-law's name who helped him start the firm, and they decided that Vicks was a better-sounding name for a product.
They were right.
Yeah, so he was from North Carolina. And so in 1944, the U.S. Maritime Commission was building a ton of these ships called Liberty ships, which were mostly made to transport cargo and things to the countries that were involved in the Allies. And anyway, these ships are actually mostly known for the fact that so many of them were constructed by women, which was new. But this one in particular, some leading African-American citizens from North Carolina specifically asked that the ship be named after Lunsford Richardson, quote, to honor the memory of a white friend, because he was just a lifelong philanthropist and supported, racial equality. So, yes, he had a ship. It was launched on sometime in October 1944. And the really funny thing about this, I actually have a PDF of the local newspaper report at the time, which was cool. The newspaper has this date, October 20th, 19. It really looks like 14. So I was like, wow, 1914, that's very early. And then I was like, wait, Liberty ships weren't made until like at least the 1930s or 40s. It actually says 1944, and the only reason I was able to figure out the actual year was that next to this report, there is another section of the newspaper that is actually a political ad advising people to vote for Thomas Dewey, who ran for president in 1944 and was defeated by Roosevelt.
So
yeah, it was a pretty cool little find. And yes, Lunsford Richardson is the name of the man who blessed the world with Vicks VapoRub, but was remembered for his social activism.
Can you link to that PDF on the website so people can read it?
Yeah.
Our website is theliberalarts.wordpress.com.
And we'll be posting links to things we talk about, hopefully, so that if you want to go find more information, you can, because I'm not an expert on a lot of the things I'll be talking about. I know about them, and I find them fascinating, but somebody's going to ask me a question eventually, and I'm going to be like, I have no clue, but here's a link.
Let's just establish right now, we are not the kind of experts that make things like Crash Course.
No.
Absolutely not.
We are just doing this because we really like this stuff, we like to talk about it, and we just think it's really fun. We're going to do our best to research the things we tell you and not lie, but we are not experts in these fields. So, yeah.
Yeah, if you have corrections for us, you can always let us know at our email address, which is theliberalarnts@gmail.com.
It'd be great to get loads of, like, corrections and dialogue going.
That would be fun.
Like, it'd be really cool if we got enough responses to start doing kind of a response section in our podcast. I think that'd be a very nice thing.
Yeah.
This sounds like a good segue into today's colloquium. Cleo, would you tell us about today's colloquium?
I would love to tell you about today's colloquium. So, today's colloquium is going to be the part of a continuing series that I'm doing about fun historical events that happened in Asia Minor, which is the peninsula that is now the modern nation of Turkey.
I'm psyched. I'm super psyched about it.
Are you going to tell us why it's called Turkey? Because
it's called Turkey because the modern, the more modern nation of Turkey was named after the Ottoman Turks.
Oh! Do we know why the American bird is called the turkey? Because
I have no idea. If someone wants to email me that information. Okay. So, The first thing I want to talk to you about in the history of Asia Minor is a people group called the Hittites. Ancient Hittites lived in Asia Minor from about 1700 to about 1200 BC or BCE, depending on which dating system you prefer to use. And they were pretty famous for a lot of reasons. One of the most famous reasons being in modern times is that they're mentioned in the Bible quite a bit. However, some scholars believe that the Hittites mentioned in the Bible are actually different from the Hittite Empire. They're part of what's really known as the Neo-Hittite Empire after the actual collapse of the Hittite Empire in Turkey, in Asia Minor. The Hittites we're going to be talking about actually did not refer to themselves as Hittites. They called themselves the people of the land of Hatti, and in a lot of ancient inscriptions they are referred to as the land of Hatti or just Hatti. So that was the name that their neighbors knew them by, the name they called themselves by.
How do you spell that?
Hatti, H-A-T-T-I.
I imagine it's spelled different in, like, the original script, yeah.
Did they write in, like, cuneiform or, like, hieroglyphics?
They wrote mostly in cuneiform. Cool. And so cuneiform is a type of writing, kind of like an alphabet. It's pictographic. And so you can use it to write in different languages. They used it to write in a lot of different languages, including Akkadian, Luwian, and Hittite. But it was also used in Mesopotamia cuneiform to write in Babylonian and Sumerian and Assyrian.
Wow. Same alphabet, but different languages?
Yes.
So you've told us before about, like, how there was translation issues with getting, like, Hittite cuneiform, like, translated?
Yes. So the Hittite Empire, their capital city was in the middle of Asia Minor. It was called Hattusa. And when it was discovered in the early 1900s, they started excavating, and they found these giant libraries full of thousands and thousands of clay tablets with cuneiform written on them. And they started translating. They could read some of them, because some of them were written in Akkadian. But the ones that were written in Hittite, they were having real trouble with, because they were assuming that the Hittites were also a Semitic people, like the Babylonians, the Akkadians, the Sumerians. And so they were trying to use different Semitic languages to crack the code of Hittite, and it wasn't working. And then they realized, about 15 years after they were discovered, there was a Czech scholar, and he was working with some of the tablets. And by this time, they had managed to transliterate the cuneiform into the Latin alphabet. So they had all the words, they just didn't have any idea what they meant. And this guy was working with them, and he realized that one of the words sounded like water. And he's like, but that's
like, it sounded like when you read it out loud?
Yeah, because they had managed to transliterate it into the Latin alphabet.
Oh, right, because it was the same, like, alphabet. That's cool. Mm-hmm.
But they didn't know what any of the words meant. So it's like if I just walked into Germany, I wouldn't. Did they use the same letters, but I wouldn't know what it meant.
Right. So he realized that this word sounds like water, and then what?
Well, water is Indo-European, which is the language family that's like English, ancient Sanskrit. It's not Semitic like Babylonian and Assyrian. He's like, why does this sound Indo-European? And then he started trying to translate on the basis that it might be an Indo-European language, and voila, it was. And then everyone told him he was crazy, and it wasn't actually Indo-European. So for a few years, they didn't believe him at all. And then they realized that it was actually translating things and making sense. So they were like, whoops. They managed to finally get a lot of things translated. The Hittites, they actually had an empire that stretched from Asia Minor all the way down to the north part of Syria. And in, I believe, the 1300s, they sacked the city of Babylon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did they win? Yes. I mean, that's what it means when you sacrifice.
I know, but like, you stole all their stuff. They didn't like take over Assyria, so like, how did that go?
I'm not really sure.
Interesting.
That was one thing that I wouldn't find much information on. It was just like, and they were so important, they sacked Babylon. Moving on.
Just because they could.
Is it like one of those Egyptian things where, like, we only write down the things that we did correct? So, yes, we sacked the city of Babylon, but we all got killed by lions on the way back? Like,
it could be. Speaking of Egyptians, Egypt, Babylon, and Assyria were known in the ancient world as the great empires or the great superpowers of the day. And one of the cool things about being a superpower back then is how you got to talk to the other superpowers. So,
I'm just picturing like the Justice League, like the Avengers over there. Like, which one of them is Batman is the only one who can't fly or whatever?
Well, I don't know if there's a character in the Justice League, because I don't really know the Justice League, who's like the new kid on the block. Then that would be the Hittites, because people had kind of forgotten about them for so long. And then they started finding all these records of them and all these ruins, and they realized that the Hittites were really important. And
Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman, vastly underrated. Wonder Woman.
Yes. The Hittites are the Wonder Woman of the ancient world.
I was going to say, like, Green Lantern, but I like Wonder Woman better. I'm just not sure. I don't, maybe I don't like the Hittites enough to let them be Wonder Woman. Maybe that's what this resistance is.
Well, by the end of this podcast, you're going to love them so much, you're going to want them to be Wonder Woman.
I think I just have it. All this prejudice, because they, like, were the bad guys in the Bible, so...
I mean, everybody was the bad guys in the Bible.
That's true.
Different Hittites. We're going to talk about the nice guy Hittites.
I mean, as opposed to the dark side Hittites.
As opposed to the dark side ones. Although I guess if you lived in 14th century Babylon, you might have a problem with them.
They came and they sacked our city. At least they got eaten by lions on the way back.
So, in ancient times, the great superpowers of the day referred when they sent dispatches and letters and memos and emails to each other. They referred to each other as brother, which was just sort of a way of acknowledging their equal footing in the world. So other kings they sent letters to would not have been referred to as brother. It would have, I guess, been something like your majesty or that king who has to pay taxes to me. But they referred to each other as brother, and they also referred to the Hittite king as brother as well.
I somehow brother surprised me. We were talking about Wonder Woman so much, having a male term was like, oh wait, they're actually all men. Never mind.
Well, there was a Hittite queen.
Ooh.
And her name was Puduhepa, and she was the queen, the wife of King Hattusili.
How are you pronouncing all these names?
Practice. In 1274, Egypt and the Hatti got into a big battle at a city in northern Syria called Kadesh. It was one of the biggest battles of the ancient world, and both of them claimed they won.
Good job, y'all.
Probably more like a...
Is this really common?
Yeah. Have you been to the London Museum?
Yeah. Well, the British Museum in London?
Yeah.
Yes.
That one. There's a big stele from Assyria.
Yes,
where
there are lots.
One of the Assyrian kings went out to attack Jerusalem and it didn't go so well.
Oh.
And all he has written down is, "We laid siege to the city." The end.
We like, sure did do that. That we did do. So good.
In 1274, they fought this big battle and it kind of ended in a stalemate. And about 15 or so years later, they signed what would become the first known peace treaty in the world, the Treaty of Kadesh. They found it written in Akkadian in tablets in Hattusas, which is the capital of Hatti. And they also found part of it written in hieroglyphics in the Temple of Amun in Karnak, Egypt.
Amazing.
So the Battle of Kadesh was fought between Ramses II, Ramses the Great of Egypt, and King Muwatalli II of Hatti. And by the time we get to the actual treaty, poor King Muwatalli is not around anymore. He died.
Aww.
And he was succeeded by his son, who was promptly deposed by his uncle, Hattusili. Ooh. And Hattusili signed this treaty with Ramses. He also gave his daughter in marriage to Ramses as sort of an alliance. Apparently there were some problems during the marriage contracting point because there's a copy I found I was reading about of a letter between Ramses and Hattusili's wife, Hodehepa, who was a great queen in her own right. She married Hattusili after he received a vision from the goddess Ishtar when he was passing through her hometown.
Nice.
Hmm.
She was a priestess of Ishtar, and her father was a priest, and Hattusili came passing through and apparently spent the night, and overnight he had a vision, and Ishtar was like, you need to marry my girl. And so he did.
Okay, and what I'm wondering about here, what I'm wondering is if this was a prostitute situation. Because a lot of priestesses back then, like, that was part of their job. And so, like, if he slept with the girl and then came, I had a vision, I should marry her, like,
definitely.
Little different story. Just saying.
And Ishtar was the Babylonian goddess of fertility.
Yes. He definitely slept with the woman and then woke up and was like, we should get married. The goddess said so.
Okay.
Either that, or she, ooh, this is even better. So she does her job as a priestess, and then she convinces him he had a dream that they should get married because she just seduced the king. Like, I'm not saying that's what happened, but it'd be a good film.
It would be a great movie. That would be such a great movie. But apparently they did love each other.
Oh, good.
Oh,
that's very good.
And it was actually sort of a love story. And she was very powerful. She, when they were brokering the marriage between Ramses and their daughter, there was apparently a fire that destroyed some of their, like, a lot of their valuables. And so Ramses sends this letter. He's like, you know, the dowry we agreed upon, it's not enough. I want more.
What?
And I want it faster. And she's, and, and, but he addresses the letter to my sister, the queen of Hatti.
Hmm.
The same way that he would call her husband my brother. And so he sends this letter, and she writes back this letter to her brother Ramses, basically saying, you know, we just had a fire, and we can't really afford to do this right now, and you're gonna have to wait because you're the son of a god, and the gods control the sea, and we have to use the sea to get to you anyway.
Yes.
So she just told him, listen, son, you know, maybe you want to chill just a little?
Sorry, the fact that you use the word son, isn't he like the son of the sun or something? Like the son of the sun god?
Yeah, she addresses him like the son of the sun god, but she refers to him as brother, and she's like, we've known each other for so long, this is never how we've treated each other, how could you treat us this way? Basically, bro, this is not how we do things.
I love that.
So, yes, Egypt definitely considered the Hittites or Hatti to be a equal power. In fact, when King Tut died, poor King Tut, when he died, his wife was in need of a new husband, and so she wrote the king of Hatti and asked him to send one of his sons down to Egypt to marry her.
Okay, like, hey, could you just, you know, can you spare, hey neighbor, can you spare a cup of sun?
Yes. Instead of brother, can you spare a dime? It's brother, can you spare a son?
You have any extras laying around you're not using?
You know, the air and the spare that you can spare for me. So this was about a century later that King Tut died in the 1300s. And yes, yeah, so his wife sent a letter to the King of Hatti, and the King of Hatti was like, this is kind of suspicious. So he sent an envoy down to figure out if she really did want to marry his son, or if this was some sort of international espionage deal that was going on.
Or just like really a spam letter.
Yes.
Junk mail.
It must have been really expensive to send junk mail back then.
You gotta hire the messenger.
Yeah,
you gotta hire like, the person to write it.
Put it down on like a clay
scribe.
Yeah.
Pay for the clay.
They send down this envoy to make sure that this is not a trap. And
it's a trap.
He determines that this is an actual offer. The queen really does need a husband, and apparently she's got some political stability going on in Egypt. There are a lot of people who want to take over after King Tut died.
Well, yeah, so she was 16.
She needs a powerful husband to help her kind of stay in charge.
Preferably she's one really... who's post-pubescent.
Right?
Yes. Preferably. But... So the envoy goes back and he tells the king, this is a real deal. She really does want to marry your son. She's kind of offended that you didn't believe her, but she still wants to marry him.
I'm just picturing, like in the Odyssey, when she's just got all these bachelors and she just won't have any of them. I'm just picturing that happening, where just, like, everyone in Egypt wants to marry this lady, so she has to go, like, quick, find someone else.
King sends his son down. Unfortunately, he is assassinated when he gets there by some Egyptian nobles.
Oh my god. It was a trap?
It was a trap. Well,
it just wasn't her trap.
Oh. She tried. She really wanted to get married to this guy and have an alliance with a powerful king. And maybe not die. But these nobles assassinated him and overthrew her and took over. And I don't really know because I didn't study that because that's Egypt and not the Hittites. One cool thing about Hatti is their capital city of Hattusa, sort of in the middle of what is now Turkey. And Hattusa was built in the mountains. It's completely landlocked. Unlike Egypt, Babylon, Assyria, they all have access to waterways, either the Nile, in Egypt's case, the Mediterranean.
So why put Hattusa where it was then? Why build it in the middle of nowhere?
The impression I got from reading is that they were really big into the natural defenses because they built it in the mountains and it was a super fortified city.
Okay.
It was like 4-mile wall around the outside of the city, 8 meters tall, with all these towers. And then when you come up from the south, there's actually a big pyramid in the wall. So there's like wall, pyramid, and the wall goes up over the pyramid, and there's this, you have to climb 100 steps up the pyramid and go through a gate framed in sphinxes.
Dear God.
Rad.
It was really cool. And
they must have had some kind of good water source, though. You can't put a city out in the middle of the desert. You need a well or something.
Well, they piped water in through aquifers.
Oh!
Through aqueducts. And so they had all these aqueducts that brought water into these giant pools in the middle of the city. And apparently one of the pools could provide enough water for 10,000 people for a whole year.
Wow.
Dang, son. Because that's what I was about to say. You said it was defensible and in the mountains. And I was like, okay. Any city can be put to siege. They need something, like water supply. So that's impressive.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if I was attacking the city, the first thing to go would be the aquifers.
Absolutely. But they had a ton of water stored.
That's nice.
And then the defenses within the walls were also, they had hollow walls in some places. So you could get through the gate, and then, boom, somebody comes outside the wall, and there's this whole, all these soldiers attacking you.
Freak yeah.
Yeah, it was really cool.
And even the walls have swords.
Even the walls have swords. And then the palace, which was in the middle of the city, also had another wall around it. So they were really big on security. Again, they were really big on military accomplishments. They redesigned their chariots to make them able to carry 3 people instead of 2.
Oh.
Which was a big help for them during the Battle of Kadesh.
That way, yeah, you got someone watching your back while you reload or whatever.
It's very nice. 2 someones.
Yeah. Well, one of them is driving, presumably.
Yeah, I was going to say, all chariots have 2 people, but having more is nice. Anyway.
The Hittites were among some of the first people to work with iron.
Iron Age.
Yes, they were in the late Bronze Age, which led to the Iron Age, so they mostly used bronze. They were among some of the first people groups to work with iron.
Cool. cool.
So do we have a lot of their, like, iron stuff?
I'm not sure. I think there's more bronze that they found than anything.
Yeah, iron tends to oxidize pretty easy, so.
So I believe when we were talking about this before, one of you asked me how we actually were able to translate the, or read the Akkadian portion of their tablets.
Yeah, like how do we know how to pronounce it?
Well, the pronunciation, I believe, comes from the fact that you can transliterate into the alphabet that we use. But the reading of Akkadian comes from an inscription in called the Behistun inscription, which was found in what is now Iran, ancient Persia. And it was written by Darius the Great. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like the Rosetta Stone because it was found in the 1840s. So before the Civil War in America, we were translating Akkadian.
Oh.
Nice.
And it was written in Old Persian, Elamite, and Akkadian. And because they could figure out the Persian or the Elamite, they could figure out the Akkadian. And then...
Nice.
Once they found the tablets in Hattusa, they could read them.
Interesting.
So, like, why don't more people know about this if it's, like, basically a Rosetta Stone?
I don't know. I started reading about it and I was like, why have I never heard about this?
Yeah, because I mean, what was it called again? The what tablet?
Behistun inscription. It's written on the side of a... It's carved in the side of a mountain.
Nice. Whoa.
Yeah, about how awesome Darius
I'm assuming they,
was.
Like, took it out of the mountain and now it's in a museum somewhere.
Probably.
Is this the Darius from, like, the Book of Daniel in the Bible?
Darius the Great, yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Sweet.
This is a big, long inscription about how the god Ahura Mazda made him awesome. And but that's how we got to the Akkadian portion of the translation. But because Akkadian was a Semitic language, it didn't help with initially figuring out Hittite. They had to go to Indo-European. The Hittites were really fascinating people, and one of the most fascinating things that I discovered that I'm going to talk about next time is their connection to entirely different set of myths and history and legends, the Trojan War.
Ooh, so rad.
Alright, postgrad problems.
Yeah, this is the section of our show we call postgrad problems, for lack of better name.
Because there are a lot of problems with being a postgrad.
So many!
So many problems.
I would like to talk today about community.
Hannah, community is too big of a topic. Like, all of the postgrad problems I'm ever going to do fall into the thing of community. Please be more specific.
Okay, so we know that part of the reason that postgrads are so messed up is because we have very little sense of community, right? And so we do things like, you know, go to church even though we don't actually believe in the God that we worship just because it's nice to have friends there. Or we do things like,
join sports teams for a sport we've never played in our lives.
And don't actually like all that much. Or, you know, create these huge online communities with a bunch of people who like similar things, you know?
Like never
podcasting.
Yes, like podcasting. And so, you know, so one of the things that I was thinking about is, like, how I think that a lot of that ends up being, like, just feedback loops, right? Like, you know, you have your online friends, and they all agree with you, and they all think the same things that you do, and there's no challenge in that, and that doesn't really foster real community. All it does is, you know, reflect back your ideas back at you. It doesn't help you grow at all. Whereas a community that's, like, physical where you are at necessarily challenges you. So I'm thinking about, like, neighbors. Like, okay, so I don't know about you guys, but I grew up in suburbia. And we never knew our neighbors. Like, I can remember, of, like, the 5 or 6 places that we lived, one neighbor that I knew.
Yeah, I'm the same. I mean, when I was a younger kid, I knew a few of my neighbors if they had kids my age. But, like, right now, I can name, like, the people who live right next door to us and the people who live directly across the street. But I live in an area of cul-de-sacs, and I could not name you the last names of everyone on that cul-de-sac. And there are only 5 houses.
I grew up, well, until about middle school, I lived in a neighborhood where I did know my neighbors very well, and we were good friends, and we were always at each other's houses, and we were always playing together, always eating together, and then we moved kind of out to the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so people out here are really nice, but we're just spread out. And so that naturally kind of clamps down on things. And then to top things off, now we have a commute issue.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
And how long do you commute into work?
For me right now, it's about 35 minutes.
Ew. Ugh.
But back in the day, it was an hour one way. And so by the time you get to work, and then so you're trying to keep up with your friends who are back where you left them, still an hour away. But, you know, you can go to work, you can leave work and go hang out with people, but then you still have to drive home, and it's taking up just a lot of time. And they can't come, they can't really come to your house that often because it's so far away.
Right.
Okay, so my question for you guys is how do I make friends with my neighbors and foster community where I am at?
Oh,
like,
that's a good question.
I know the first step is talking to them. And yeah. To some extent, there is a language barrier, because, like, some of my neighbors are... I live in student housing, and so a lot of my neighbors are, like, international students.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's really different when you live at a university, because I'm also in student housing, but, Cleo, you're not in student housing.
No, I'm not. I'm currently in parent housing.
Yes, I will be the summer. I think that's a big difference. For me, it's easier to talk to other students because then at least you have kind of a how's your studies going? Remind me what your project is, that kind of talk.
At least at university, you have that whole somewhat of a shared space. So I know,
yeah.
Rissa, you've said you guys share a kitchen with random people.
So I share a kitchen with a couple other people.
You could technically sit in the kitchen.
No, there are no chairs in the kitchen. It's like a little bitty hallway kitchen. But you could at least talk. Yeah, and like my university has a common room and things like that. But I know, like, because I'm very bad at this, I can't give you advice on how I make friends. But I know, like, my mom she goes to a group. They play bunco, and it's just kind of just neighbors, like just from the neighborhood. So I know, like, some communities will have things like that. And I guess if yours doesn't, you can always try starting one. For us, like, one of the girls that I share a kitchen with, she often tries organizing kind of just game nights. Our common room, we convinced the common room to buy some board games and things. And so now every once in a while, she'll be like, hey, if people are around for the weekend this Saturday, we're going to do a little game night.
I'm actually considering moving.
Oh, yeah. Yes, we've talked about this.
Yeah, tell us about this.
Well, because of the distance and everything does make it harder for me to connect with people, and also because there are things that I want to be more involved with.
Like what?
Well, so right now I'm teaching an English class one night a week. I teach adult ESL, and it's in the neighborhood that I grew up in with a lot of people that I know. But it's an hour away.
Right.
And I would really love to be more involved with the group that does this. But time and money. And so,
commute. Yeah.
And commute. And so I'm really strongly considering trying to move back to that area just because I know that there are things. And it's not just wanting people to hang out with. It's wanting to actually do things.
Right.
You know, I wanna be involved with teaching English. I wanna help with the food bank and things. And something I really feel strongly about, but I'm very hampered in how much I can do now because of the space. So,
right.
I don't know what the ultimate answer, and I don't think it's gonna fix all the problems. Obviously, you can't just show up in a place and be like, now I have community. You still have to work at it, but I think that it's a place that has good potential for me.
Yeah. I think one of the only answers I can think of for community is just being intentional about things. I have several friends who just, thank goodness they are intentional, because I'm very bad at that. But I have several friends who every couple of weeks will just be like, hey, do you want to get lunch? Do you want to get tea? There's a film in a theater.
And they've been great, really intentional about kind of keeping up connection with me. And I think that's a really good thing to do, is just, hey, I haven't seen you in a couple weeks, let's go get lunch. The more of these podcasts we do, I think the more we're going to get into this issue. Like I said, almost every kind of post-grad problem I've thought of since we got the idea for making this part of the podcast is all community stuff. I mean, I've been living here for just over a year now, and I feel it's kind of recent that I've had friends here, like friends, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the fact that I'm moving again in July is frightening. I am moving home to where my parents live, but I don't know anyone there anymore. I really did lose contact with everyone I went to high school with. So
yeah,
that'll be interesting.
I moved back to my hometown after like a year after graduating, and I was born and raised here my whole life, and I came back and it was basically like moving to a new city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone except for a very few group of people who actually, first of all, they made the effort to keep up with me when I was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big thing I've realized, discovered that when you move, you think you have community, and then you move, and everyone's just like, okay, it was nice knowing you, bye. But then it doesn't really hit you unless you move back to that place, I think. And mm-hmm. then you're just like, oh, wow, I really don't know anyone here.
Yeah.
I thought I did, but I don't, and my life has moved on, and their life has moved on, and so now you have to create this whole new life.
That is really strange, but my experience was so different, you know, because I moved back to my hometown and I had like high school friends sort of, but most of what I did was hang out with my family because I missed them.
Right.
And then I came here up to just nothing. There's no community up here. Hello, welcome to Montana. We don't have very many people. Oh, and you know, I live in a city, in quotes, but like, I knew nobody, you know, there was nothing. The people that I met were, you know, I had one conversation with when I visited, when I was looking for grad schools, and I knew nobody, and it was so strange and so alienating. Like, if it hadn't been for, like, constantly texting you, Rissa, and Christian and the efforts that we made to like Skype friends occasionally, then I would have it was awful. Now I have community, but that's because I joined not one but two churches.
Wow. Okay, calm down, woman.
All the community.
All of it. Just everything.
Like I said, I don't really get to talk because, like, the first thing I did when I got here was join a sports team. I've never played sports in my life, so. yeah. No, but I really do like what you said about intentionally finding community in your physical space. I think it's very easy to find community online.
Oh, yeah.
And that community can be diverse in lots of ways, but it's gonna be the people you handpicked, and those are not going to be the people that challenge you.
Yeah.
I think it's funny because we've talked about this. I mean, when I left school, I moved straight to Florida, and then I moved straight back here, and I realized that even talking about physical community, one of the big things is that when you move to a brand new place and you don't know anyone, either because you've never been there or because
it's been a while,
you moved back and everything's changed, then you get about 2 months in and you look around and you're like, no one hugs me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Moving to Britain, especially, I don't know people's, like, I've lived in Texas my whole life, and then I moved to England, and it's like, I've been told that British people are less, like, okay with that kind of thing. So I was like, do I hug people? I need physical contact, and I just wasn't getting any at all, ever. So I have a few friends now that, like, I see usually at church, and we kind of hug hello, but it's still kind of, like, different. I don't know. It's not there.
Yeah. Listen, one of the reasons I joined church number two is that I walked in and was immediately hugged.
Yes. That's a good reason.
By people I did not know, and I'm like, oh, this! I missed this!
Yeah. I just need hugs. This is why I need a dog.
This is why we all need a dog.
Just one dog to share.
No. I want my own dog to hug. My dog, mine. When I moved to Florida, I had this realization about 2 or 3 months in that, you know, I'm still kind of getting to know people. And because I spend so much of my time at work, because I was in an internship, I was working all the time, that kind of puts, like, a professional barrier to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Even with people that you're becoming friends with and you like to be around. And then we had this whole new group of interns come in from South America. And they didn't have any of those reservations. They just hugged everyone.
Yes.
And it was wonderful. They quickly became some of my favorite people because they just walked in and, like, a day later, they just, I know you, and tackle you in hugs.
Yay.
Okay, guys, I love you. My voice has held up well enough thus far. It shall not much longer.
So, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa, which is actually my name.
And until next time, learn something worth knowing.